All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 15. In this ancient history program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class, we're entering into our first test week. So let me tell you how we are going to proceed here. Today is going to be the last lecture of new material relating to the upcoming test. So what we do typically in a History at Our House academic year is we divide the year up into pretty reasonably divided equal parts, into approximately six equal parts, and we have six tests. And so they will come approximately every 6 weeks. What we do is we collect together the content that we have studied over the course of the prior weeks. We engage in a concentrated effort to integrate the meaning of that material so that we have a good foundation to proceed to the next part of the course, and so on and so forth. History material in this course, in History at Our House in general, is cumulative in the sense that you don't just study a bunch of stuff, then take a test, and then forget it, and then go study a bunch of new stuff, and then take a test and then forget that, and so on and so forth, which is unfortunately very much the traditional experience that I, in people of my generation and those that have come before you, and sadly those that are all around you in government schools today, and private ones for that matter as well, are used to. We have a serious problem in terms of education, not just in the United States, but around the world. So it's a real challenge here to come up with a proper approach to teaching, and then beyond that, to testing, and to putting all of those various things together. My method has a lot of various parts to it, and it includes testing. And testing I consider to be very important in this program, so much so that if you want to go from one level to another in this program, I want to see your tests. I want to see that you've taken them. I want to see how well you did in them. And I want to be able to validate your progress in test taking as a really significant, important measure of how well you understand. In this course, the tests are designed to do a number of things, but ultimately the overall meaning of the tests is integration. What we do is we take a large sum of work that we've done, and in this case it amounts to 6 weeks worth of work, and then we concentrate our effort on that content over the period of a few days in a phase of preparations, and then we concentrate that further into a single test-taking exercise, which should take about an hour. And the purpose of undertaking such an activity there's a lot of different reasons for doing it. But one of the reasons, and I know that not everybody likes tests, and I know that some parents and some students have a variety of reasons why they might not want to take tests or don't want to and don't like to and so on, okay? But I'm going to just briefly articulate why I think it's important that you do try to take the tests in this course. Or at least that you push yourself in that direction if you're not ready to do it quite yet. The fundamental reason why it's important to do the test as a part of this program is that tests are not just a part of school, but they are a part of life. We are, in a very literal sense, tested in life. when we come up against difficult circumstances, when we come up against challenges that we have to deal with, that we have to rally to our resources to meet a challenge, when we have to enact an extraordinary effort in order to overcome a problem. Life is full of tests. So we go along and we have a kind of rhythm in our life. It's usually pretty comfortable. We are very fortunate in that regard, and certainly in the modern world, we get to kind of coast along, and it's a pretty darn nice life, absolutely, okay? But then, things happen sometimes, and we've got to enact a special effort, whether it's a deadline at work where you've got to submit a report, or whether it's whether you're in a tournament, you're a football player and you're going for the national championship, or you're whatever, right? You're in a chess tournament, you're up against another player. These are the tests in life where the level of difficulty gets cranked up on us. And we have to know how to do that. We have to know as human beings how to meet those challenging circumstances. And one of the ways that you can learn this art and skill and strength and strengthen yourself as a person is by taking tests in school. And so this is part of my testing philosophy, is that you're going along here, you're listening to me talk. It's a pretty comfortable existence. You don't have to give it your all. I don't know each and every one of you, you know, what your level of commitment is, what your level of interest is, what your motivation is. So I don't know how much you're putting in. Okay. But, when you come up against the test, you have to do it, right? You have to now take it seriously and work harder. And, the more that you work throughout the year, the easier the tests are, the easier. And that's another truth in life in general, is that the harder you work in general, the easier it is, the stronger kind of person you are, and the more capable you will be in general in meeting life's tests. But regardless, you know, the art of rallying to deal with challenges in life is a test. And that's what this is designed to do, is to concentrate that your experience of learning into, first of all, a few days and then a single hour, and get you to rally and put out that extra effort in that extra moment. Okay, so we're going to be concentrating the material of the last 6 weeks into a couple days worth of work. And it looks like the following. We'll start with step one in this concentrated effort. This is me here giving you very, very, very specific guidance in what to do, okay? Especially if you haven't done it before. So step one in your test prep is collecting together all of the class notes. The class notes are a written record of the material that you're responsible for. And you will see that in order to make this easier on you, I've already posted the week 5 and 6 class notes that contain everything that you will be responsible for on the test. So if you haven't already done so, you need to go back and print off the prior week's class notes. So every week typically has a set of class notes. Week 4 class notes are with lecture 11. Week 3 class notes are with lecture 8. And you can go back to the August website and get the week 2 and the week 1 class notes as well. Okay, and now we're down to week 5 and 6 here. And if you were to click on that and get the PDF ready to go to print it off, right, you'll see the type of material that you're expected to know. Most of it we have discussed in detail in class. But your job in order to prepare for the test is to read through this and confirm for yourself whether you get it or not. Right? To look through this and make sure that you understand it. Check yourself on the vocabulary. Do you know what an artifact is? Right? Think about these words. Think about the word decipher. I mean, interesting terms that you encounter. Steely and so on, right? Sometimes I define them right in the notes. But make sure that you go through the notes and make sure that you understand what they all say. And so that's job one. And I would say that you should do that today. You've got how much? You have 7 pages of typed class notes. That's not a lot. Got 7 pages of typed class notes. Okay? And that's what you're responsible for. So, read it. Make sure that you know it. Tomorrow, we'll go over it in a survey of the material. We're going to do a review class. Okay? So, tomorrow, we'll do 2 things. Tomorrow, we will do this as an in-class exercise to prepare you for the test, and we will read the class notes together. I mean, not word by word, but I will go through them and check your understanding. It'll be your chance to ask me questions, and if you don't have questions for me, I'll have questions for you to make sure you get it or not. And then what happens after tomorrow, once we've undertaken that, is you will get test preparation sheets. Since this is test one and it's a little bit shorter, it's going to end up being a little bit shorter and somewhat easier than later tests. We're starting the test preparation. I'm giving you the test preparation sheets on Tuesday. As you'll see later in the year, you'll start to get them on Monday. When the tests get longer and harder, I will start to hand them out even a day early. But tomorrow, you'll get them for test one. You'll get them tomorrow. And then you'll have 2 days to work on them. Okay, and you will have history through art on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we will look at the answers that you have produced for the test preparation sheets, written down, using your notes for research. Your full written answers on the test preparation sheets, we'll look at those on Thursday, and I will give you feedback on them to see how well you did. And then you will receive the tests on Thursday and you'll have the entire weekend to do it. So that's the procedure. Questions or comments? Most people here have done this before, so not surprised. I think everybody's going to be able to handle this quite well. But anyway, you have it. You have the material that you need in front of you now, so make sure you get it. Of course, somebody like Keen, if you're in the high school class, you don't get these class notes. So your exercise is to compare what it is that you've got in your notes with what it is that we do and say in class and make sure that your notes are complete based on what the rest of the groups is talking about. So you have a higher level exercise. So that goes for anybody who is on the recordings, for instance, at the high school level, right? If you are writing down notes as we do things in class, this is also your chance. The test preparation phase for you consists of the validation of your notes, which is a very important exercise. You get to do that at this level. By the time you get to the college level, you don't get a phase like this. The teacher's not going to give you a week to review your notes and compare them to the things being said in class. You're not going to get a review period. You basically just got to use them. And good luck to you. All right. So let's now finish up with the content. These notes already, this segment here, 3000 BC, as far back as we can see. That's the last part of the course. We're going to talk about the Narmer palette again here today and kind of get complete the picture with regard to this document. And as it turns out, it is a document of sorts. And when we're done with that, basically what we will have accomplished, which is so important for us in this particular course. What we will have accomplished is we will have gotten from where we are, here and now, all the way back to the beginning. You will have that, you know, basically this anchor fact, which is the last anchor fact, as far back as we can see, 3000 BC, you will have been able to go, you will now be able to go all the way back to that spot. And so you'll be in the right position, basically, to be able to follow the story from now on. Because that's what we'll do. We'll start covering the history of Egypt, and then we're going to connect up other stories to it, and so on. And we're going to work our way forward. But we'll do that within the context of a framework, our portal and chart of our awareness of the past here, that allows us to see where everything that we do fits. Every single thing that we look at, we'll know where it is within that framework. So we'll always be able to trace our way back to the present. Think about the question, who cares? Why does this matter? How important is it? And so on. So this is this imagery here that we are looking at is the final building block, the final anchor fact in that mission of ours to set up the framework. And so yesterday, or rather last week, last class, we were looking at this primitive work of art, and we were saying, okay, the artist here has depicted this central character on the left-hand side as a conqueror. He's showing this character with a club. He's showing him dominating this kneeling figure in front of him, and presumably ready to strike and end his life. And we see that there are characters at the bottom looking back and fleeing in fear, being driven before him. We also see that this character is attended by a servant who's carrying his sandals and like a pitcher of water or something like that. So symbolically, he is attended by his own personal servant. So before we now go to the second half of this tablet to understand what the artist is saying here, what this work of art is meant to depict, we have one other thing to look at, which is the very curious symbol that is embedded in the top right-hand side of the tablet. So I don't know if you've had a chance to look at this or were interested to look at this before class, but here we are. And it's very curious, very difficult to decipher what it is. But what do you make of it? Abby, what do you see?
I see a bird holding a string in its talons, the string leaning down, something that looks like a small boat with a bunch of paddles sticking out of it, and a human head is the bow of the boat.
Okay, nice, nicely done, right? Okay, that is fairly interpretive. In fact, when to call this a boat, I don't know what's but you know what? That's a good, taking an awfully good shot at it here. Are these paddles? Is this the bow of the boat with kind of like a human head? What is this object here that connects the bird and so on? Right? These are the symbols that we have to, that Egyptologists have had to contend with. Juliet, what do you make of it?
My first impression of the bird was that it was blanking on the name of it though. Not an eagle. It's
a falcon.
Horse.
Yes, a falcon. Mm-hmm. The god Horus, right, which we took a sneak peek at a couple weeks back when I showed you some kind of Egyptian painting or something on papyrus there was depicted as a falcon. Right. So that if we're assuming that this is kind of continuous symbol or one that was the same at the beginning of Egyptian history and later on. Okay, this could be a god, right? We could have a kind of depiction of an Egyptian god. That makes sense. Okay, but we still have a kind of a mysterious symbology here, right? What are these objects? What is, why is there a head? What is this? Why is it connected to the mouth of the head and so on, right? So, pretty peculiar symbol. Here's what historians have made of it. Historians have said, well, okay, we're going to go with this kind of Horus symbol, right? So the falcon represents the god, the sun god, pretty much at the top of the hierarchy of Egyptian gods. Okay, this character down here represents the god of the Nile. This long, narrow kind of, you know, a body, right? But it's not a, it's not like an animal body or anything. It's more like just the banks of a river. So it's just a long, narrow object. And so this is the god of the Nile. And I don't know if he's drinking from the power of Horus or the other way around or something, right? It looks like kind of like a straw or a snorkel of sorts. So there's some kind of divine relationship here. And out from the waters of the Nile emerge these papyrus flowers. Is kind of what his, you know, symbologists have made of this particular depiction. So the papyrus plant, as we're going to learn more about, was really essential to Egyptian life. And it was papyrus that they would write on. So it's one of the reasons why we are able to know Egyptian history, because they wrote on papyrus. So historians are kind of guessing that this is a symbolic depiction of essentially of Egypt, and very much an Egyptian kind of version of it, right? A kind of supernatural world around the Nile, and its life-giving power probably given to that life-giving force comes from the gods. But it's basically meant to set the context for what it is that we are observing, which makes sense because that's how art works. Even as far back as 3000 BC, which is pretty neat, right? The artist has a main character. He has an action that is occurring. And then he sets up these peripheral objects and symbols to give context and meaning to the central action. All right, so this is a story of Egyptian history. It's a story of a great warrior and conqueror. What did the great warrior and conqueror accomplish? Well, let's go take a look. It says on the next side of the tablet. And when we look on this side of the tablet, we can be drawn to a number of different things. There's no, of course, necessary order for our first impressions. But what is the main feature of this side of the tablet? Excuse me for a sec. I got to sneeze. Usually comes in threes. Might have to sneeze again. Okay, so anyway, what's the main feature on the right-hand side, Theo?
It looks like two feline-looking creatures with extremely long necks.
Okay, there was the second sneeze. Yes, two feline-like creatures. Let's go ahead and zoom here so we can get it closer. This is definitely the main feature, right? The main panel of this side has this very dramatic depiction, kind of symmetrical depiction, right, of two creatures, quite magical-looking creatures, right, with extremely long necks that are intertwined, and which seem to be harnessed by two people, and they are meeting in the center. And it creates this kind of circular shape here. It really gives you a sense of them kind of weaving together. Alexander, what did you want to add?
I was going to talk about the top half, and then since you zoomed in, I was going to talk about the guys with the ropes or whatever they are, but then you talked about that.
Oh, okay, all right. So I preempted you on all that. Okay, well, I'll let you talk about the top panel in just a minute, right? So the question is, again, this is symbolic, right? So what is it a symbol of? becomes the question, right? We have a combination of kind of realistic things and then more magical or symbolic elements on the tablet. So, Abby, did you want to take that on?
Maybe it's a symbol of taking power over things because the two men are kind of taking power with their ropes around the creature's necks.
Okay, yeah, right. The harnessing of that energy and that power of these magical creatures definitely would have to be one of the ideas, right? That is pretty straightforward. But what's interesting to me is the way that the two creatures are depicted, right? Let's say they are not side by side proceeding in the same direction. When we compare this part of the tablet to the top half of the tablet, well, we'll see that there's an obvious kind of left-right direction to that part of the tablet. But this is two sides coming together. Right? They're facing each other, they're symmetrical, and they intertwine. So that's the question, kind of, what is the meaning of that? Why would the artist choose that kind of a symbol for the two things coming together? We'll come back to that at the end to see what we can make of that. But we're going to let Alexander narrate here what he thinks he can see when it comes to the top half of this particular tablet. Alexander, go ahead.
Well, on the right side, there are a bunch of bodies with no heads stacked on top of each other, even though they somehow have floating gaps in between them. And then yeah. On the left side,
okay,
we have this really, really tall Menes Narmer with a bunch of short people behind him, next to him, and then there are some even shorter people who may or may not be children, or they could just be somewhere in the background, who knows, holding up a bunch of sticks, it looks like, with some kind of somethings on the top.
Okay, so what do you make of that?
I'm not really sure, but I think they're just holding, like, I can't really make it out very well, but I think they're just holding some sort of thing.
Okay, what would it be? Why are they in this orderly, set, like this one in front of the other, with these really large poles, with these various kind of things at the top of them? What could we perhaps propose that might mean, Rosie?
Well, it really looks like there's like...
Sorry, say it again, you're breaking up.
Like statues of birds, it looks like statues, like on top of the poles.
Like, well, okay, but you wouldn't really be able to hold statues like that, right? They'd be extremely heavy, right? But you're right that we seem to have birds here. All right, so what would be another take on that? To go with the symbol of the birds is significant because we had the falcon, kind of the big version of the falcon on the prior side of the tablet. That's helpful. So what would they be up on the top of poles like this? I mean, we have to imagine that these people are no more superhuman than anybody else, right? They're carrying these, so they can't be that heavy. What would they be, Julia?
They're almost like flag tops, so the almost ornate thing on the top of flags.
Yeah, right, flags, banners, just kind of ornate, symbols. And if they are walking like this in single file with a bunch of different banners, and some of them depicting gods and so on, and they're all kind of in a line here, Theo, what do you make of it?
Well, it looks like it could be some sort of parade. Maybe an army.
Yeah, or like a victory parade here, right? We have the fallen army, we have the defeated army, and the realism of it, we cannot get too stuck up on that, right? I mean, it is primitive ancient art, so it's nothing like what we would expect a great painting to be like. This is an artist who's trying to capture something in stone, which is a difficult medium to start with, but it's primitive art. So the depiction is not realistic, but it's more symbolic. And certainly the fallen, enemies, definitely that's very understandable, very easy to see. The procession with the various banners of maybe representing different gods, And then we have this large character again. Notice that he has the club again. But let's focus a little bit more on this character and that set over there. Abby, go ahead.
This was just about that top part of the right-hand tablet. Is that the bodies without the heads is really...
creepy.
Creepy, yeah.
Yeah. I know. I mean, not only do they not have the heads, but the heads have been, you know, carefully organized between their feet. So, yes, it's absolutely barbaric. And so, you know, we have ISIS today that the world seems so much at a loss what to do with the barbarians, but they are notorious for beheading their enemies and displaying them in this, you know, barbaric fashion. So evidently, it's not, you know, they didn't invent that. It's tragically a feature of you know, human beings' barbaric conduct towards each other in this type of setting. So this is something that we have to definitely think about, is what, you know, what's happening here? What does it all mean? And what is the significance of the fact that people behave like this towards each other? Why it is so prevalent in history and so on? It's definitely one of those themes we have to pursue. Theo, go ahead.
So it's about the tall person. Looks like they got a new hat.
Yeah, exactly. So this now is this hat that has this very strange decorative features to it. Different type of a style. So when we go back to our painting, that will maybe jump out at you as well. You can go back to the history through art and you'll see that. So as it turns out, what historians learn subsequently is that the crowns, that these two hats are in effect crowns for the two halves of Egypt. So the character on this tablet is wearing what is known as the crown of Upper Egypt. And the character on this tablet is wearing what's known as the crown of Lower Egypt. So, and then when you look on the painting below, throughout Egyptian history, it was basically the mark of the pharaoh. It was the symbol of his unified power over all of Egypt, that he wore them both at the same time. Abby, go ahead.
It just made me think he's going through and conquering everything.
Yeah, in this tablet here, we have this victory parade. And over here, he is parading as the king of Lower Egypt. All right, so over there, on the other side, he is the king of Upper Egypt conquering. Here, he is now the king of Lower Egypt parading. Alexander?
Just wondering, how big is this Narmer pellet?
That's a good question. I don't know the dimensions. We could possibly jump over to Wikipedia briefly and take a look. There might be a description of it. But one of the things that's kind of a useful little thing on this tablet that helps connect the two sides is notice the supporting figure is on both sides. So that gives a kind of symbolic unity to the two sides. So if I pull back a little bit here and have them both on here, notice that this flower pot kind of a symbol is located next to the character on both sides. So the artist is reminding us this is the same guy. And he's still carrying the sandals. And he's still carrying the water. Right, so it's the same supporting character over here to remind us. This guy's him, it's him over here, and it's him over here. That's a clever little element on the painting. And then basically, a variety of symbols are featured here, and some of them are hieroglyphic. It's hard to make them out, but typically some kind of object floating it can be kind of surrounded by something else, or, you know, this one over here, for instance, will contain some kind of hieroglyphic inscription. I'm not sure how well we can make this one out. This is about the clearest one. Yeah, we really can hardly make that out. But this is the first tablet, historically kind of what one historian called the first document in history. Because it has these hieroglyphic symbols, so we can identify, thanks to Champollion and the Rosetta Stone and Egyptology and all that, we can identify what's written here. And the historians basically figured out, okay, this depicts a character named Narmer. They're going through all the records and they're translating that just massive amount of data that they've got to work with in Egyptian history. And they're figuring this out. They're deciphering this tablet and its various symbols. And they're saying, okay, this is a guy named Narmer. And what he's doing is he is wearing the crown of Upper Egypt on one side, and he's wearing the crown of Lower Egypt on the other side. So this is a symbolic representation of Upper Egypt conquering Lower Egypt. And we didn't look at the bottom here on this particular tablet, but there's another further kind of supporting symbol. So there's one obvious part, one not so obvious part to it. So again, what do we see going on down here? I don't know if you can make out this particular symbol. That's kind of the harder part to it. Theo, what do you see?
Well, I see someone running or maybe falling down.
Mm-hmm. Right? So we have this sprawled figure over here. But the thing is, he's being touched by
a bull.
Yeah, this bull, and being trampled by him, basically, right? I mean, the bull is stepping on this character and squishing him. He definitely does not look like he's doing well here. So he's being trampled by this bull. But the thing is, what's the other thing that the bull is doing, is the question. What is this other symbol over here, kind of on the right-hand side? Juliet?
Well, to me, it looks like a walled city, basically.
Yeah, we have kind of like a building of some sort. Not quite a pyramid that we're used to in Egypt, but, you know, a structure with structures here. And then we have this circular wall around it. And so what's the symbol there?
A city.
Okay, but what's the bull doing with his horns, basically?
I don't know.
Okay, what does a bull do with his horns, Abby?
Maybe he's charging into the city.
There you go. I mean, we don't see any walls over here, right? The walls are all around the city over here. But I don't know if these are meant to be fragments of the wall, probably. So he's charging in and breaking it up. And so, again, we have this other symbol of conquest. I don't know if the bull is meant to represent the man or any of the serpapards. The historians call these serpapards, meaning serpent leopards is the term. They aren't spotted, so maybe they, I don't know, but anyway, so they call them serpapards. And you can go to the Narmer palette page on Wikipedia if you're really curious about more of the details of it. But yeah, basically, we can just do that briefly because we can answer one question about that. It might be interesting to know how big this is. So if we go to the Narmer palette on 64 centimeters, so about 2 feet tall and 42 centimeters across. That's pretty big. That's pretty big, actually. So about two feet by, a foot and a half across. So it's an important find. It's that it was found basically in perfect shape. So that's, we're very fortunate about that. Here's this quote from Egyptologist Bob Breyer that says, "This is the first historical document in the world." Good quote. Basically true. It talks about this character named Narmer. When put together with all of the other artifacts that we have concerning the story of early Egypt, what we have here is the idea that he is the unifier. He is the character who ruled over the part of Egypt we call Upper Egypt. You can look at your geography map if you need a reminder of what that was. And then he conquers Lower Egypt. And so it becomes one country. Becomes one unified culture. And presumably this was the first time that that happened. And the unity was sustained after that. Egypt became Egypt rather than two kingdoms, became one. And so this is where Egyptian history starts. After this, we have a continuous record. The quality of it varies, but we have a continuous record. We know the events that characterize Egyptian history, and we're going to survey those over the coming weeks. Why is it called the Mene? It's called the Narmer palette. Why do I refer to the character in this story as Mene's Narmer? Well, I think I might have mentioned it before, but I'll say it again if I have to here. And that is because the Greeks knew this person as Mene's. In other words, the Greeks, and especially the Greek historian Herodotus, had collected together the stories of all the other cultures in the Mediterranean. And there was a story about this legendary unifier of Egypt, and the Greeks called him Menes. So it's an unusual thing that we have kind of two versions of the name, and they seem to be very different from each other. But I think it's a good idea to link the two together, because on the one hand, we have the idea of Narmer that we get through the Rosetta Stone. We get that through, you know, that bridge that we have constructed to the archaic past. But it's also good to know, and at a kind of higher resolution awareness of history, one of the things that you do find is that there's more than one bridge to ancient Egypt. And the Greeks were one of those bridges, right? I mean, the Rosetta Stone was written in Greek along with Egyptian scripts. And the Greeks knew a lot about ancient Egypt, which was one of their neighbors in the Mediterranean. And they thought about the history of Egypt and were interested in it. It ended up being lost, but when they thought about it, it was Menes. So I like the combination of the names. So that's why we write Menes Narmer in this class, to link those two traditions, the ancient Greek one and the modern historical tradition. All right, so that's it. We're now back at the beginning. We go all the way back to the beginning of history. And so when we come back after the test, we will follow this story of archaic Egypt, see what happened to it over its many thousands of years of history. And, of course, we'll have to ask ourselves all along the way, okay, what's this worth to us? How much does this matter? What is the relative merit of this content? What does this tell us about human life? What can this do for us here and now, 5,000 years later? How much of this do we need to know becomes an important question. As we'll see, there's not too much. All right, but we're there now. So tomorrow, final reminder today. Tomorrow, I want you to be ready with this at the beginning of class. We'll see how quickly you can fill it all in. And with this, all of the class notes. Keen, what's up?
So on Saturday, I looked on the high school class webpage for the facts practice version of the Portland chart.
Okay.
Chart, and I couldn't find it. I sent you an email about it.
Okay.
You may have only posted the junior high one.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to thank you for telling me. So I'm going to write myself a quick note here. So post facts practice to the high school webpage. Thank you. All right, I didn't check my email over the weekend, but I will definitely fix that before tomorrow's class. Thank you. Okay, good. Anything else? All right, folks, go read your notes. Time to rally here and get ready for this test coming up. Good luck. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.